Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Today we will be taking sutta number 20 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called in Pali the Vitakka Santana Sutta. In English it's translated freely, very freely, as the removal of distracting thoughts. Though that is not the literal meaning of the Pali title. Well, actually, the literal meaning might be something like the stilling of thoughts. And through my friend Venerable Analio, I learned the sutta has a counterpart in the Chinese Tripitaka, which would have a title that is called something like Adichitta Sutta, the sutta on the higher mind, which in a way might be a more adequate title for the sutta, since it has a wider scope than Vitakka Santana, which applies to only one of the five methods recommended by the Buddha. Okay, so the sutta begins when the Buddha was living in the Jetas Grove, and then he addresses the monks and speaks about a monk, a bhikkhu, who is pursuing the higher mind. This is in Pali, Adichitta. He speaks about a monk who is Adichittang Anuyutena, one who is pursuing, one who is devoted to, one who is intent upon the higher mind, Adichitta. And we know already that from some earlier suttas that what is meant by adichitta is a mind which is attained to the stages of samadhi. Particularly, the Buddha uses it to refer to the four jhanas. The four jhanas are said to be the characteristics of the higher mind. And so the Buddha is now speaking about one who is practicing for the purpose of attaining to the jhanas, or to reach some level, deep level of samadhi. And the Buddha says from time to time he should give attention. He uses the expression that comes from the Pali, pancha nimittani. The word nimitta here has various meanings. Here it's translated five signs. Often the word nimitta has the meaning of object. And in the later Buddhist literature, especially in the commentaries, this meaning becomes more and more pronounced. So that one's nimitta, it's the object of meditation. Particularly it refers to the visualized nimitta, or the visualized object, not so much the grosser object that one begins with, but refers to a very subtle visualized object which might appear sometimes like a bright light, a star, a luminous disc that appears as an indication that the mind is becoming concentrated and that one is starting to approach a state of deep samadhi or concentration. And then that will become, the mind will leave off, drop the grosser object with which one began, and then focus upon this nimitta, this visualized or inwardly perceived object. And then that becomes the object upon which the mind focuses to enter into deep samadhi, particularly to enter into jhana. But the word nimitta in the suttas has various meanings, and sometimes it means cause or condition. And here it seems to be used with the meaning of method. And there's a little scope for some confusion, because in the immediately following paragraph, it seems to be used in the sense of a beginning object of meditation, a basic object of meditation. But, so we have the word nimitta, sign, being used with two different senses in these two paragraphs. In paragraph two, it has the sense of method. In paragraph three, the sense of object, though not yet the sense of the subtle visualized object, but just any object, even a gross object of meditation. Okay, so in this sutta, the Buddha is going to be teaching five special methods for training the mind when the mind gets deflected from its main meditation object, in order to bring it back on track and redirect it towards the attainment of the higher mind, the mind of samadhi or concentration. Okay, so we come to paragraph three. Okay, so the Buddha says, here, monks, when a monk is giving attention to some sign. Here, sign, as I said, seems to mean simply an object. And owing to that sign, there arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, connected with hatred or aversion, connected with delusion. Then he should give attention to some other sign, that is, to some other object connected with what is wholesome. When he gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, connected with aversion or hatred, connected with delusion, are abandoned in him and subside. And when they are abandoned, then his mind becomes stabilized or steadied internally. Ajjatameva chitang santitati. Santitati means that the mind settles down or becomes stable. Sannisidati, actually, santitati, better, stabilized or steadied. Sannisidati, that settles down, becomes quiet. Ekodi hoti, becomes unified. Here brought to singleness, too wordy, becomes unified. Samadhiyati, becomes concentrated. In other words, samadhiyati, it gains samadhi, gains concentration. And then to illustrate this, the Buddha uses a simile. This is like a skilled carpenter or his apprentice. Now he has a piece of wood, and there might be inside that piece of wood a coarse peg which might be getting rotten, and he has to replace it. And so to get rid of that coarse peg, he'll take another peg which is narrower and put that narrow peg against the coarse peg, take the hammer and hit it with the hammer until the narrow, so that the narrow peg forces the coarse peg out of that block of wood. And so the Buddha repeats the same thing to complete the simile. Okay, this is the method of replacing an unwholesome thought with a wholesome thought that is directly opposed to that unwholesome type of thought. Now, generally, it says that when one is developing a particular meditation object, for example, mindfulness of breathing, which is a neutral object, it's a wholesome object, but it's neutral in that it's not especially directed to one defilement rather than the others. So if thoughts connected with desire, with aversion, with delusion should start to arise, one doesn't immediately abandon that main object and develop another meditation subject. One should use some simple method first of just noting that thought and then just simply applying a little effort to push it away and bring the mind back to the main object. But now this is a case where a particular thought might become more powerful, you say obsessive or obstinate, so that it is difficult to overcome that thought just by a simple act of will, simply by noting the thought, letting it go, and bringing the mind back to the main object. So here one has to use special methods. By taking a thought or an object which is directly opposed to that unwholesome type of thought. And here the Buddha's commentaries give a rather complex system of explanation of what types of meditation objects to use to overcome what types of unwholesome thoughts. Okay, so thoughts connected with desire. This usually means sensual desire.
Here the word in Pali is chanda.
Okay, so desire can be directed either towards persons or towards things. The commentaries use the word sankharas, which means formation. But simply we could say towards things, desire for wealth, property, possessions. Luxury items. Anything that arises and obsesses the mind. Okay, to overcome when the desire for persons, which usually means the strong sexual desire, when that arises, and remember this is advice given to meditating monks, the same thing would apply to meditating nuns. But I don't want to offer this as an apology, because in Buddhist countries it's common for monks, when they're preaching, also to teach this to lay people. And I know lay people practice this also on special occasions and find it very beneficial to help take, what I call, the cutting edge of sensual desire. Okay, so the particular remedy which is proposed, the antidote for quenching the flames of sensual desire, is something called the meditation on the unattractive nature of the body. And then this is done systematically by, in the text, the body is analyzed into some 32 parts, which are taken as topics for close examination. So one begins by taking the outer parts of the body, the parts that are immediately visible. Usually the mind naturally grasps the way perception works. Perception seizes upon the appearance of the body as a whole. And so we see the body, take it as a whole, just in terms of a superficial impression. And so we think, ah, the body is something beautiful, lovely, attractive. But what does one really see? What do the eyes actually register? What one sees with the eyes are only five things. Hairs of the head. Hairs of the body. Hairs on the hairs under the armpit. Hairs of the legs. Fingernails, teeth, skin. Okay, so this is what we see with the eyes. And one takes these things individually, runs them over with the mind, taking them separately. If you have hairs of the head put out, somebody sees the beautiful actress appearing on television, or you see the beautiful model in the magazine, she's advertising a new type of hair lotion, such beautiful shiny hair, but you come up with a scissor, cut off the locks of hair, put them out on the table, say, are they beautiful? No, not beautiful. Okay, then, does anybody think the hair of the arm or the armpit beautiful? No, I don't think so. So you don't even have to talk about cutting that one off, but shaving it off and putting it down. Then the fingernails, oh, what lovely hands you have. Clip, 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 cut the fingernails, put the fingernail clippings down. Did I mention the teeth? Okay. Teeth. Beautiful smile, lovely teeth. Has to go to the dentist. Dentist takes out the... I'm sorry, but you have to have your teeth removed. Dentist pulls out the teeth. Now you put the teeth out on the table. Do you want to take the teeth? No. And then what lovely skin. But take the skin separately and not very lovely. Okay, so you take, those are the five parts that you see, the five parts that are immediately visible. When you really examine them part by part, not very lovely. Okay, so one goes through first the five parts that are visible, then using the scalpel of thought, after one goes through these parts, up and down, up and down, up and down, then one sort of uses the scalpel of thought to go beneath the skin till one gets to muscle, muscles, sinews, bones, bone marrow. One goes through each of these inside, up and down, up and down. Then one comes to the inner organs, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, lungs, spleen, lungs, going through these part by part. Then intestines, mesentery, stomach, excrement, brain, back and forth, back and forth. Okay, those are the solid parts of the body. Then one goes through the various fluids, liquids of the body, until one has this clear conception of these 32 parts of the body. One goes through up and down, till one can go through all of them and get a very clear image of them all. And then when you take these 30, when you become familiar with going through the 32 parts, contemplating them in sequence like this, one sees that individually they're not very attractive. Then one puts them all together and one has this, again, this composite image of very beautiful, attractive, million-dollar model standing in front of you, Miss America. What is she? But composite of these 32 parts. And so then this image of, this sensually enticing image is dispelled, or should be at least temporarily, till the mind becomes, loses that perception, then of course the thoughts can come back again. But as one becomes more and more accustomed to this contemplation, then gradually that perception becomes a powerful force which weakens the grip of sensuality on the mind. Okay, so that is the remedy for overcoming the attachment to the appearance of beauty. And that attachment to the appearance of beauty, that is the cause or condition which stimulates the arising of sensual desire. Okay, then there is the attachment to objects or things, the desire for objects, things, possessions. Okay, so one imagines, if I only had this, if I only had that, that will satisfy my desires. A new car, new house. Even monks have this, these thoughts. Even a monk living in the forest can think, if I only had a new alms bowl. The monk next in the cottage next to mine, he has a nice shiny alms bowl. I have, yeah, these are the thoughts that come up. I have a scratchy, blackish alms bowl. He has this new style that's appeared in Thailand. Silver-colored, shiny, yeah. They started coming into Sri Lanka from Thailand, and you see, some monks are there with their shiny Thai alms bowls, others still have the standard blackish, grimy Sri Lankan-style alms bowls. And so, yeah, I know monks are start scheming, how can I contact somebody who's going to Thailand? They can pick up a shiny silver arms full, bring it back. Okay, so the way to I do have a shiny silver one sometimes. Then when the ones came into silver ones started coming into Sri Lanka, then the elder said, you can use it, but you have to make the outside black so that others don't start seeing the shiny, silvery outside and then become envious of you. Okay, so the way to overcome this is by, one way is by reflecting on the impermanence of all conditioned things. So when you get a clear perception of impermanence, even doing it reflectively, this is not yet the insight knowledge of impermanence, but just a reflective examination, considering, thinking that whatever arises has to pass away, and so whatever I might acquire, any possession I might gain, eventually has to come apart. Okay, so this takes care of the thoughts of desire directed either to persons or to things. Then the next type of unwholesome thought are unwholesome thoughts connected with aversion or hatred. Okay, so when aversion or ill will arises towards other persons, then the direct antidote, the direct remedy for that is the meditation on loving-kindness, or metta, metta-bhavana. And so one will then put aside the main meditation object, say mindfulness of breathing, and spend a short time developing the thought of loving-kindness towards other persons, usually not beginning if one has especially strong feeling of ill will towards a particular person. One wouldn't begin with that person, but one works in the systematic way, first taking oneself, then dear persons, then beloved persons, then neutral persons, then coming finally to that person that one has some feeling of antagonism towards. And one will work on this for some time until one can overcome those feelings of ill will. Then one would return to the main meditation object. Then there can be feelings of ill will or aversion towards inanimate things. It could be feeling of ill will, displeasure, because of maybe climatic conditions. Could be a feeling of aversion towards that ordinary, very unattractive, blackish alms bowl that one has. Feeling of aversion towards one's living quarters. Whatever, anything, sort of situation, conditions, objects towards which one has some kind of feeling of displeasure. One can't develop loving kindness towards that, but one develops, one applies to it the analysis in terms of elements. That is, one considers that this particular set of conditions is just a coming together of the four, if it's a material situation, the four primary elements. The elements of earth, the solidity, liquid, heat, and air. Or if it's displeasure, ill will because of some situation or circumstances, then one just reflects on the fact that these conditions or this situation is brought about through conditions. And these conditions might be conditions over which I have no volitional control. One way is to reflect on this in terms of one's previous karma, that these conditions are brought about through my past karma, and what I am receiving now is just the result of my past karma. Which doesn't mean that one should just be completely passive and not make any attempt to change one's condition. But this is if this becomes a thought in one's meditation, an obsessive thought, then in order to accustom oneself to accept one's conditions, then one can contemplate this, reflect upon it in the light of the workings of karma. Okay, then the case when unwholesome thoughts arise connected with delusion. Actually, all unwholesome thoughts are connected with delusion, but the types of thoughts which are especially connected with delusion are thoughts in which the mind is obsessed by doubt. This is in the situation of, in terms of the five mental hindrances, this would be the mind obsessed by doubt. And it seems to me that there are two types of doubt, what I would call emotionally based doubt and intellectually based doubt. Emotionally based doubt would be, you say, a lack of trust, a lack of confidence, a lack of devotion to the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. And intellectually rooted doubt would be unclarity about the teaching, doubt how to understand the teaching. The mind maybe becomes obsessed about thoughts, how to figure out the teaching, how to understand this, what do I do in this situation, how do these teachings apply under these conditions. Okay, emotionally rooted doubt, actually, it's often overcome by clarifying intellectual doubts, and then one gets more confidence in the Dhamma, and that brings more confidence in the Buddha. And so that helps to settle the emotional doubt. But one way to deal with emotional doubt in its own way is to do this recollection of the qualities of the Buddha, since that inspires devotion, greater confidence, greater joy in the Buddha and his teaching. And it spurs one to greater endeavor in practicing the teaching. Then the intellectually rooted doubt, to deal with this, sometimes one would have to leave off one's actual meditation. And at least if one is doing intensive meditation, one would have to leave that off and devote oneself to a period of studying the Dhamma, or go to find teachers and ask them about the issues that are troubling one in order to have one's doubts clarified. The commentary says the way to overcome this intellectual doubt, it gives five things. It says one should dwell with the teacher, then one should undertake study under the guidance of the teacher, one should question about particular points of doubt, the fourth, one should go to listen to the Dhamma, listen to discourses on the Dhamma, and the fifth is that one should discriminate what are the causes for particular things and what are not the causes for particular things. I think this is by studying those scriptures which speak about the conditions for certain, like what are the conditions for the five hindrances, what are not the conditions. what are the conditions for the arising of the seven enlightenment factors, what are not the conditions. Maybe I'll ask if there's any questions, since this is a rather very broad area. That's a good, very good, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, I'd say here one is not really yet going so deep into the perception of non-self, but one just uses the idea of elements as a way to see that the thing that one is forming aversion to, yeah, that it's just like a combination of elements, and so there's no point having aversion towards it. But by the same token, one doesn't take these assignments of antidotes to illnesses in too rigid a way, because one could also apply the analysis into elements to aversion towards persons. So if one has aversion towards person, maybe loving kindness, one has some trouble developing loving kindness, but one could use the analysis of the person into the elements. And then, even though it might not give a deep perception of non-self, but just analyzing the person in terms of the elements or in terms of the five aggregates, what is this person I'm angry with? Just form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. There's no, well, yeah, one brings in, there's no self there, no truly existent person, just these five aggregates. They're all arising, passing away, nothing to be, to have a grudge against. And similarly, you could use impermanence rather than unattractiveness as an antidote to the desire for person. So when the commentary makes these alignments of antidotes to persons, antidotes to particular problems or afflictions, it should be understood just in a general way. Any other questions? Yeah. Yeah. Sloth and torpor. Actually, sloth and torpor also would fit under delusion. Sloth and torpor would fit under delusion. Yeah. Yeah. Because it's, in sloth and torpor, neither greed nor hatred is particularly dominant. And it's a kind of, it's a dullness of the mind. The mind is overcome by a dullness. And then the fourth hindrance, restlessness and remorse. Restlessness, according to the Abhidharma way of analysis, would come under delusion. But there doesn't seem to be a very prominent antidote to that in terms of the scheme which is offered by the commentary. The antidote to restlessness would be something that makes the mind calm, which would be a peaceful meditation subject. Basically, mindfulness of breathing is the most peaceful. And remorse is actually connected with, it's an offshoot of aversion, because it's a kind of self-criticism, self-condemnation. So it's not overcome by loving-kindness. So there are other antidotes for it, but it doesn't quite fit into the scheme of particular meditative methods that one attends to. So the commentary simplifies a little bit in order to give clear-cut explanations of how to deal with these three types of problematic thoughts. Any further questions? Then shall we go on? Okay, second case. Okay, this is paragraph 4. If, while he is giving attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, some other object connected with what is wholesome, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then he should examine the danger in those thoughts thus. These thoughts are unwholesome. They are reprehensible, blameworthy. They result in suffering. When he examines the danger in those thoughts, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, connected with hate, connected with delusion, are abandoned in him and subside. With their abandoning, again, his mind becomes steady, internally quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. And now the text uses a somewhat strong simile. Just as a man or a woman, young, youthful, and fond of ornaments, would be horrified, humiliated, and disgusting if the carcass, that's the body, the corpse, of a snake or a dog or a human being were hung around his or her neck, so too, then the text continues in the same way. Okay, so in this way, one just considers when these unwholesome thoughts arise, that these thoughts are unworthy, that they are defiling thoughts, that they lead to, that they're blameworthy, that they are unwholesome, that they lead to suffering in the future. And in my notes, I said that one example of this type of reflection is that which the Buddha used during his own quest for enlightenment in Sutta number 19, which we explained last week. So you can just refer back to that sutta for an example of this. Okay, now we'll go on to the next method. While he is examining the danger in those thoughts, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with aversion, with delusion. Then he should try to forget those thoughts and should not give attention to them. And here the word that the text uses, it says, asati amanasikaro. Now, asati means lack of mindfulness. Amanasikara means non-attention. And usually, always, the Buddha says one should develop mindfulness. One should be attentive. One should have attention. So here the Buddha is saying, asati amanasikara. It doesn't mean that the Buddha is saying that one should give up mindfulness, stop paying attention. But here he's speaking about a case where these thoughts become very obsessive and one has made an effort using several techniques to overcome these thoughts, but still they're coming into the mind and one might be still trying to use the sitting meditation to overcome them. And the methods one has used, using an opposite type of thought, thinking of the unworthiness of these thoughts, and it hasn't been successful. And these thoughts are really becoming troublesome. Usually these will be sensual thoughts or angry thoughts, which are really disturbing to the point that they become sometimes overwhelming, that one doesn't know how to deal with them. Here what the Buddha is advising is that one should find some other way of preoccupying the mind. Engaging the mind in some other activity so that it doesn't have the chance, you're not giving a chance for these thoughts to come running into the mind. One way that the teacher suggests, for example, just stop the meditation and take a walk in maybe a beautiful countryside where you see nice scenery, so the mind can just relax into the scenery, enjoying the sight of mountains, clouds, waterfalls. Or in those days they didn't have washing machines, so if you have some clothes to wash, instead you stop meditating, you have to go down to the river to wash your clothes. It's a real time-consuming process. It takes a lot of effort and exertion. You have to put the clothes into the river, soak them, rub them with the... In those days they didn't have bars of soap. They used this chunam, this kind of lime powder. And then you have to beat the cloth against the flat rock. You do that in Taiwan, I think. Excuse me?
Very long time.
You have piece of board. In truth, they do have that in China. Yeah. In Sri Lanka, they always go to the river where there are these flat rocks, and then they roll the cloth up. They're very skilled in this, and then they take it, they beat it against the flat rock. No, they are very skilled. It doesn't, they don't ruin it. Okay, anyway, find something else to keep the mind preoccupied. Okay, another way using meditation is to do the walking meditation, keeping the mind preoccupied, maybe observing just the touch sensation of the feet when you're hitting, when the foot is hitting the ground, touching. So then the mind is getting engaged with the touching sensation. And so that is keeping the mind away from these troublesome thoughts. And then the commentary says, if this doesn't work, what you can do is, in effect, empty out your drawers and take the content of the drawer, put it on the top of the desk, say, this is my handkerchief, this is a key, this is a spare clock, this is my... maybe you keep address cards that people give you, address card of this person, that person. So the mind just gets engaged in something else and it's no longer preoccupied with these troublesome thoughts. Okay, then when the mind gets preoccupied after some time and the troublesome thoughts are away, then one can return to one's primary meditation object. And then the mind can come back to quiet state, and then the mind can become brought to the stillness, singleness, and concentration. Okay, then we come to the fourth method. Okay, suppose one is trying to forget these thoughts, and one is not giving attention to them, and there still arise these evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with aversion, with hate, aversion, and with delusion. Now here comes the difficult phrase in the Pali. I'll write it out on the blackboard in the Pali. It's tesang vitakanang vitaka sankara santanang. manasi katabam. It's actually the phrase that gives its title to the sutta. Vitaka sankara sankara. Okay, if while he is trying to forget those thoughts, okay, and is not giving attention to them, etc., then he should give attention to vitaka sankara santana, which is translated here to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts. Before I explain what this might mean, I'll just go on through the simile. Okay, when he gives attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with aversion, with delusion, are abandoned in him and subside. With their abandoning, his mind becomes internally stabilized, settled, unified, and concentrated. Okay, now the simile. Just as a man walking fast might consider, why am I walking fast? Let me walk slowly. And he would walk slowly. Then he might consider, why am I walking slowly? What if I stand still? Then he would stand still. Then he might consider, why am I standing? What if I sit down? And he would sit down. Then he might consider, why am I sitting? What if I lie down? And he would lie down. By doing so, he would substitute for each grosser posture one that was subtler. So too, when a bhikkhu gives attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts, his mind becomes steadied, internally quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Okay, so we have here a process, according to the simile, of shifting from a grosser state to a subtler state, from walking fast to lying down. And this is illustrating what is meant by this method of dealing with these disturbing thoughts. And now, how is this actually to be applied? According to the commentary, the commentary says that one should attend to the root of the thought. That when one has the troubling thought, one attends to the root of the thought, which means one attends to the cause of the thought. One asks, why am I thinking this thought? Then one attends to the root of the root. One asks, why is there such a cause for me to be thinking that thought? In other words, what is the cause that underlies the cause for these thoughts? And then one goes back and further in the chain of causation, what is the cause behind the cause for the cause of these thoughts? And so as one goes back through this sequence of causes, then tracing the cause for this thought, the cause for that thought, the cause for that thought, in this way, the mind settles down and becomes still. It's not so much an analysis into elements, but it's, in fact, this is not yet a kind of analytical investigation aimed at insight in the sense of, you know, deep insight into the three characteristics. It's more a skillful means for helping to overcome these disturbing thoughts, for stilling and stopping the production of these thoughts. And that is the way this is explained by the commentary, but I'm not sure that the commentary is exclusively correct here. Or at least this might be one way of explaining this phrase. It's a rather obscure phrase in the original text. And I would see it this way, an alternative to the explanation given by the commentary. Okay, one has these thoughts going through the mind, like this is the way, a method that I have used, rather than trace chains of causation, one just focuses upon the thought itself and just watches the thoughts. And when one just watches the thoughts, flowing by one after another, just keeps on watching from a kind of detached objective standpoint, without focusing the mind, trying to focus the mind on anything, not trying to focus on the breath, on sensations in the body or anything else, but just stopping, observing the flow of thoughts, watching the thoughts flow by, gradually the flow starts to slow down, and become slower, till that flow becomes very, very slow. And then the production of thought breaks off, and then the mind becomes still and quiet. So what is taking place here, it's not a matter of engaging in an analytical investigation of the causes of the thoughts, but just observing one's thoughts and saying, why am I thinking, you know, why should I let myself think these thoughts? Not why am I thinking in the sense of what is the underlying reason for these thoughts, but just as the person walking quickly just lets himself slow down, stand, sit down, lie down. So one says, why am I engaging in the stream of thoughts? Just observe the stream of thoughts, and on their own let them slow down. Come to a standstill, and then sit down and lie down. Did that answer your question? Okay, so now suppose the meditator has applied all four of these methods, and still there arise in him these evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion. Then the Buddha says, with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he should beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. That is, he now uses force, the force of the wholesome mind, to suppress the unwholesome mind. Now it's interesting, I think I pointed this out in the note here. No, I don't. But these phrases about pressing the teeth, clenching the teeth and pressing the tongue against the roof of the mouth, beating down the mind with the mind, when the Buddha, before his enlightenment, as a bodhisattva, was engaging in his meditation, I think this is in sutta number 36, then he used this method in a very early stage of his practice. Yeah, this is in sutta number 36, paragraph number 20. And there, that practice was part of his ascetic practice. It was a kind of practice that he later considered wrong practice. because it was a very forceful, suppressive engagement with the mind. But later, the Buddha didn't rule it out completely. When other gentler methods do not succeed, and one has to use force, then the Buddha says, force is acceptable. But it's acceptable as the last resort. Initially, one should use these gentler, more skillfully designed, more psychologically skillful methods. Psychologically more skillful methods. Okay, so when he's using this forceful crushing of mind with mind, then he's able to eliminate these unwholesome thoughts and his mind becomes unified and concentrated. Okay, then we come to paragraph 8, which is the summary of everything that is said. When a monk is giving attention to some sign, but now the Buddha recapitulates, he brings together all of the methods that he's explained so far. When the monk is giving attention to some object, an object, and owing to that object or sign there arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire and so on, then when he gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, any such evil, unwholesome thoughts are abandoned in him and subside, and the mind becomes concentrated. Second, when he examines the danger in those thoughts. Third, when he tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them. Fourth, when he gives attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts. And fifth, when he beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind, then his mind becomes internally, or steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Then this bhikkhu is called a master of the courses of thought. He will think whatever thought he wishes to think. He will not think any thought that he does not wish to think. Okay. At that point, the Buddha has shown simply how the monk is the master of the courses of thought. And now he's going to conclude by showing that this monk now goes on to attain arhatship. He has severed craving, flung off the fetters, that's the 10 fetters, and with the complete penetration of conceit. This is the very subtle underlying conceit, what's called asmimana, the conceit I am, the imagination. I am, that there is a truly existing I. He has made an end of suffering. Well, this conceit here is called, the word conceit is simply mana, but there are different types of conceit, and most people have a grosser type of conceit, thinking, I'm better than they are, I'm just as good as they are, that's a type of conceit. And even the thought, I'm not as good as they are, I'm inferior to them. Even that is considered, in Buddhism, that's a type of conceit. It's called... That is something, a different issue. Okay, but those are gross, what I'm talking about, these conceits, I'm better, I'm equal, I'm worse, those are grosser types of conceit. But they all come from the subtler underlying conceit is called the conceit I am. Asmi mana. Asmi means I am. And that type of conceit that remains lying in the mind of everyone up to the stage of arhatship. Even anagami, the non-returner, wu wang, even the non-returner still has this conceit, I am. Okay, if there's any questions. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I think one would have some idea that the thoughts, one knows that, okay, desire here, aversion, delusion, one knows that these are the three unwholesome roots, and so one has some sense that, okay, one knows that these are the three unwholesome roots, and so one would know that thoughts that are connected with those three unwholesome roots will be unwholesome. It would take a certain degree of maybe skill and observation and skill in the capacity for self-examination to be able to pinpoint one's thoughts with precision and then to identify them as thoughts connected with desire, with aversion, with delusion. And then to see, to recognize them as being unwholesome. And also in the initial stages, you know, when just what I would call light thoughts connected with desire, aversion arise, and when one is working with the main meditation subject, for example, mindfulness of breathing, or it could be contemplation of sensations in the body, then when stray thoughts arise, one doesn't immediately put the main meditation object down and attend and use these special methods. So it's only when these distracting thoughts acquire a certain degree of strength, a certain degree of obsessive force, that one uses these special methods. And so it's when those thoughts acquire this obsessive force that one is already able to recognize them as being...
Exactly.
Yeah. But it's the thoughts that occur in the earlier stages, lightly, subtly, when they're not detected, and when one subtly, even without fully being fully aware of it, when one allows oneself to drift with them, that they start building up momentum to the point where they can gain that obsessive force. Which is why in the early stage one should recognize those thoughts, even then for what they are, and lightly label them, and then put them down and come back to the main meditation object. But one doesn't use this, what I call it, heavy labeling. This is unwholesome, blameworthy, resulting in suffering. I think that's when the thought really becomes very powerful, very oppressive, that one uses that method. I would say also, this is what is being used here, is what one is bringing in here, these two mental factors, two mental qualities of Kiri and Otapa. I think I've mentioned this previously, the sense of shame, which doesn't quite mean the same thing as shame in English, and fear of consequences, the sense of this, maybe a sense of honor and fear of consequences. Like through one's sense of honor, one doesn't want to be overcome by these unwholesome thoughts because they're blameworthy. And then through the fear of consequences, one doesn't want to be overcome by them because they result in suffering. So one could see from that statement, the thoughts are unwholesome. The fact that they are reprehensible, that is pointing to hiri, the sense of shame, or the sense, inner sense of honor, the sense of inner dignity, that is to protect one from those thoughts. And otapa, the fear of the consequences, because they result in suffering. Sukhi? That is true. Okay, the question is, these would not be just beginners starting off with the meditation, but presumably this will be somebody who's already gained some knowledge of the fundamentals. In fact, the fact that they are striving for the higher mind would imply that they already have some understanding of what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. I think that would be just prerequisite for engaging in the meditation aimed at the jhana. Okay. I don't want to say that the commentary is wrong. Certainly not. It's based on the opinions of teachers, thinkers, practitioners who are far wiser than I. But I just wanted to say that one might understand it in another way. And I think the way that I explained also makes sense in the light of the simile. That's obsessed by the thought. I think you might have seen it in the note to Sutta number 36. Maybe. No. No, it's not there. Okay, anyway, it's the wholesome mind with its volition, by the force of its volition, crushes the mind which is obsessed by these distracting, disturbing thoughts. It's chaita sa chitang. But it's actually the same thing. It's the same. It's chitta crushes chitta. Okay, I think we're going to have to stop now. It's getting late. And then next week we take sutta number 7. That's the simile of the cloth. Bhattupama sutta. Okay, we do the sharing of the merit. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahidika punyantam anumodipa chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahidika punyantam anumodipa chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahidika punyantang anumodipa chirang rakantu mantarang. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. And one more edit. Bhavagupadaya avichihe tato etantare satakayupapana rupi arupicha asanya sanyino dukha pamuchantu Bhu Santu Nibhutin, which means from the highest realm of existence down to the lowest plane of existence, may all beings within this interval and those in the form realm, in the formless realm, those with perception, those without perception, may they all be released from suffering. May they all attain perfect peace.